Chapter 7. It was a beautiful spring day in May, 1262, that Norman of Torn rode alone down the narrow trail that led to the pretty cottage with which he had replaced the hut of his old friend, Father Claude. As was his custom, he rode with lowered visor, and nowhere upon his person, or upon the trappings of his horse, were sign or insignia of rank or house. More powerful and richer than many nobles of the court, he was without rank or other title than that of outlaw, and he seemed to assume what in reality he held in little esteem. He wore armor, because his old guardian had urged him to do so, and not because he craved the protection it afforded. And, for the same cause, he rode always with lowered visor, though he could never prevail upon the old man to explain the reason which necessitated this precaution. It is enough that I tell you, my son, the old fellow was wont to say that for your own good as well as mine, you must not show your face to your enemies until I so direct. The time will come, and soon now, I hope, when you shall uncover your countenance to all England. The young man gave the matter but little thought, usually passing it off as the foolish whim of an old dotard. But he humored it nevertheless. Behind him, as he rode down the steep declivity that day, loomed a very different Torn from that which he had approached 16 years before, when, as a little boy, he had ridden through the darkening shadows of the night, perched upon a great horse behind the little old woman, whose metamorphosis to the little grim, gray, old man of Torn their advent to the castle had marked. Today the great, frowning pile loomed larger and more imposing than ever in the most resplendent days of its past grandeur. The original keep was there with its huge, buttressed Saxon towers, whose mighty 15-foot walls were pierced with stairways and vaulted chambers, lighted by embrasures which, mere slits in the outer periphery of the walls, spread to larger dimensions within, some even attaining the area of small triangular chambers. The moat, widened and deepened, completely encircled three sides of the castle, running between the inner and outer walls, which were set at intervals with small projecting towers so pierced that a flanking fire from long bows, crossbows, and javelins might be directed against a scaling party. The fourth side of the walled enclosure overhung a high precipice, which natural protection rendered towers unnecessary upon this side. The main gateway of the castle looked toward the west, and from it ran the tortuous and rocky trail down through the mountains toward the valley below. The aspect from the great gate was one of quiet and rugged beauty. A short stretch of barren downs in the foreground, only sparsely studded with an occasional gnarled oak, gave an unobstructed view of broad and lovely meadowland through which wound a sparkling tributary of the Trent. Two more gateways led into the great fortress, one piercing the north wall and one the east. All three gates were strongly fortified with towered and buttressed barbicans which must be taken before the main gates could be reached. Each barbican was porticoised, while the inner gates were similarly safeguarded in addition to the drawbridges which, spanning the moat when lowered, could be drawn up at the approach of an enemy, effectually stopping his advance. The new tower towers and buildings added to the ancient keep under the direction of Norman of Torn and the Grim, old man whom he called father, were of the Norman type of architecture. The windows were larger, the carving more elaborate, the rooms lighter and more spacious. Within the great enclosure thrived a fair-sized town, for, with his 1,000 fighting men, the outlaw of Torn required many squires, lackeys, cooks, scullions, armorers, smithies, farriers, hostlers and the like, to care for the wants of his little army. 1,500 war horses, besides 500 sumpter beasts, were quartered in the great stables, while the east court was alive with cows, oxen, goats, sheep, pigs, rabbits, and chickens. Great wooden carts drawn by slow, plodding oxen were daily visitors to the grim pile, fetching provender for man and beast from the neighboring farmlands of the poor Saxon peasants, to whom Norman of Torn paid good gold for their crops. These poor serfs, who were worse than slaves to the proud barons who owned the land they tilled, were forbidden by royal edict to sell or give a penny's worth of provisions to the outlaw of Torn, upon pain of death, but nevertheless his great carts made their trips regularly and always returned full laden, and though the husbandmen told sad tales to their overlords of the awful raids of the devil of Torn in which he seized upon their stuff by force, their tongues were in their cheeks as they spoke, and the devil's gold in their pockets. And so, while the barons learned to hate him the more, the peasants' love for him increased. Them he never injured. Their fences, their stock, their crops, their wives and daughters were safe from molestation, even though the neighboring castle of their lord might be sacked from the wine cellar to the ramparts of the loftiest tower. Nor did anyone dare ride roughshod over the territory which Norman of Torn patrolled. A dozen bands of cutthroats he had driven from the Derby Hills, and though the barons would much rather have had all the rest than he, the peasants worshipped him as a deliverer from the lowborn murderers who had been wont to despoil the weak and lowly, and on whose account the women of the huts and cottages had never been safe. Few of them had seen his face, and fewer still had spoken with him, but they loved his name and his prowess, and in secret they prayed for him to their ancient god, Wadden, and the lesser gods of the forest, and the meadow and the chase, for though they were confessed Christians, still in the hearts of many beat a faint echo of the old superstitions of their ancestors. And while they prayed also to the Lord Jesus and to Mary, yet they felt it could do no harm to be on the safe side with the others, in case they did happen to exist. A poor, degraded, downtrodden, ignorant, superstitious people, they were, accustomed for generations to the heel of first one invader, and then another, and in the interims, when there were any, the heels of their feudal lords and their rapacious monarchs. No wonder then that such as these worshipped the outlaw of Torn, for since their fierce Saxon ancestors had come, themselves as conquerors, to England, no other hand had ever been raised to shield them from oppression. On this policy of his toward the serfs and freedmen, Norman of Torn and the Grim, old man whom he called father, had never agreed. The latter was for carrying his war of hate against all Englishmen, but the young man would neither listen to it, nor allow any who rode out from Torn to molest the lowly. A ragged tunic was a surer defense against this wild horde than the stout lancer and emblazoned shield. So, as Norman of Torn rode down from his mighty castle to visit Father Claude, the sunlight playing on his clanking armor and glancing from the copper boss of his shield, the sight of a little group of woodmen kneeling uncovered by the roadside as he passed, was not so remarkable after all. Entering the priest's study, Norman of Torn removed his armor, and lay back moodily upon a bench with his back against a wall and his strong, lithe legs stretched out before him. "What ails you, my son?" asked the priest. "That you look so disconsolate on this beautiful day, I do not know, father," replied Norman of Torn, "unless it be that I am asking myself the question, what it is all for. Why did my father train me ever to prey upon my fellows? I like to fight, but there is plenty of fighting which is legitimate, and what good may all my stolen wealth avail me, if I may not enter the haunts of men to spend it? Should I stick my head into London town, it would doubtless stay there, held by a hempen necklace. What quarrel have I with the king or the gentry? They have quarrel enough with me, it is true, but, nathless, I do not know why I should have hated them so, before I was old enough, to know how rotten they really are. So it seems to me, that I am but the instrument of an old man's spite, not even knowing the grievance to the avenging, of which my life has been dedicated by another. And at times, Father Claude, as I grow older, I doubt much, that the nameless old man of Torn is my father, so little do I favor him, and never in all my life have I heard a word of fatherly endearment or felt a caress, even as a little child. What think you, Father Claude? I have thought much of it, my son, answered the priest. He has ever been a sore puzzle to me, and I have my suspicions, which I have held for years, but which even the thought of so frightens me, that I shudder to speculate upon the consequences of voicing them aloud. Norman of Torn, if you are not the son of the old man you call father, may God forfend that England ever guesses your true parentage. More than this, I dare not say except that, as you value your peace of mind and your life, keep your visor down and keep out of the clutches of your enemies. Then you know why I should keep my visor down, I can only guess, Norman of Torn, because I have seen another whom you resemble. The conversation was interrupted by a commotion from without, the sound of horses' hoofs, the cries of men and the clash of arms. In an instant, both men were at the tiny unglazed window. Before them, on the high road, five knights in armor were now engaged in furious battle with a party of 10. Or a dozen other steel-clad warriors, while crouching breathless on her palfrey, a young woman sat a little apart from the contestants. Presently, one of the knights detached himself from the melee and rode to her side with some word of command, at the same time grasping roughly at her bridle rein. The girl raised her riding whip, and struck repeatedly but futilely against the iron headgear of her assailant, while he swung his horse up the road, and, dragging her palfrey after him, galloped rapidly out of sight. Norman of Torn Ron sprang to the door, and, reckless of his unarmored condition, leaped to Sir Mortimer's back and spurred swiftly in the direction taken by the girl and her abductor. The great black was fleet, and, unencumbered by the usual heavy armor of his rider, soon brought the fugitives to view. Scarce a mile had been covered ere the knight, turning to look for pursuers, saw the face of Norman of Torn not 10 paces behind him. With a look of mingled surprise, chagrin and incredulity, the knight reined in his horse, exclaiming as he did so, "Mon Dieu, Edward, draw and defend yourself," cried Norman of Torn. "But, your highness," stammered the knight, "draw, or I stick you as I have stuck 100 other English pigs," cried Norman of Torn. The charging steed was almost upon him, and the knight looked to see the rider draw rein, but, like a black bolt, the mighty Sir Mortimer struck the other horse full upon the shoulder, and man and steed rolled in the dust of the roadway. The knight arose, unhurt, and Norman of Torn dismounted to give fair battle upon even terms. Though handicapped by the weight of his armor, the knight also had the advantage of its protection, so that the two fought furiously for several minutes without either gaining an advantage. The girl sat motionless and wide-eyed at the side of the road, watching every move of the two contestants. She made no effort to escape, but seemed riveted to the spot by the very fierceness of the battle she was beholding, as well, possibly, as by the fascination of the handsome giant who had espoused her cause. As she looked upon her champion, she saw a lithe, muscular, brown-haired youth whose clear eyes and perfect figure, unconcealed by either bassinet or hauberk, reflected the clean athletic life of the trained fighting man. Upon his face hovered a faint, cold smile of haughty pride as the sword arm, displaying its mighty strength and skill in every move, played with the sweating, puffing, steel-clad enemy who hacked and hewed so futilely before him. For all the din of clashing blades and rattling armor, neither of the contestants had inflicted much damage, for the knight could neither force nor insinuate his point beyond the perfect guard of his unarmored foe, who, for his part, found difficulty in penetrating the other's armor. Finally, by dint of his mighty strength, Norman of Torn drove his blade through the meshes of his adversary's mail, and the fellow, with a cry of anguish, sank limply to the ground. "Quick, Sir Knight," cried the girl. "Out and flee. Yonder come his fellows." And surely, as Norman of Torn turned in the direction from which he had just come, there, racing toward him at full tilt, rode 3 steel-armored men on their mighty horses. "Ride, madam," cried Norman of Torn, "for fly I shall not, nor may I, alone, unarmored, and on foot, hope more than to momentarily delay these 3 fellows, but in that time you should easily make your escape. Their heavy-burdened animals could never overtake your fleet palfrey." As he spoke, he took note for the first time of the young woman. That she was a lady of quality was evidenced not alone by the richness of her riding apparel and the trappings of her palfrey, but as well in her noble and haughty demeanor and the proud expression of her beautiful face. Although at this time nearly 20 years had passed over the head of Norman of Torn, He was without knowledge or experience in the ways of women, nor had he ever spoken with a female of quality or position. No woman graced the castle of Torn, nor had the boy, within his memory, ever known a mother. His attitude therefore was much the same toward women as it was toward men, except that he had sworn always to protect them. Possibly, in a way, he looked up to womankind, if it could be said that Norman of Torn looked up to anything. God, man or devil, it being more his way to look down upon all creatures whom he took the trouble to notice at all. As his glance rested upon this woman, whom fate had destined to alter the entire course of his life, Norman of Torn saw that she was beautiful, and that she was of that class against whom he had prayed 4 years with his band of outlaw cutthroats. Then he turned once more to face her enemies with the strange inconsistency which had ever marked his methods. Tomorrow he might be assaulting the ramparts of her father's castle, but today he was joyously offering to sacrifice his life for her. Had she been the daughter of a charcoal burner, he would have done no less. It was enough that she was a woman and in need of protection. The three knights were now fairly upon him, and with fine disregard for fair play, charged with couched spears the unarmored man on foot. But as the leading knight came close enough to behold his face, he cried out in surprise and consternation.